There are a million ways to make money in the food service industry. You just have to find one. On the Titans of Food Service podcast, I interview real life movers and shakers in the food game who cut through all the noise to get to the top. My name is Nick Portillo, and welcome to the Titans of Food Service podcast. Let's jump right into it. Welcome back to another episode of Titans of Food Service. I'm your host, Nick Portillo. And today I welcome the dynamic founder of Alohi Strategic Advisors, Stephanie Lind. Stephanie's career didn't follow a traditional trajectory. It began with hands-on experience, running routes at Frito-Lay, driving trucks, and laying the groundwork for her future in this industry we call food service. From there, she embarked on a transformative journey, pioneering national account teams at companies like Nabisco, and delving into roles spanning sales, marketing, and supply chain across diverse channels. Her tenure at PepsiCo and Sysco's chain division, Sigma, honed her expertise across retail, food service, and industrial, all while navigating the complexities of both publicly and privately held companies, as well as ventures backed by venture capital and private equity. In 2015, drawing inspiration from her mother's entrepreneurial spirit, Stephanie founded Alohi Strategic Advisors, a venture aimed at empowering small, natural, and sustainable brands to thrive in the food service domain. Love that. Yet, her appetite for challenge led her to a pivotal role at Impossible Foods, where she spent nearly 2 years crafting and executing groundbreaking strategies. Now, as her company approaches its ninth year, which is crazy, her and I, we both started our business at the same time 9 years ago. Stephanie's return to Alohi marks a new chapter of growth and empowerment. With a commitment to fostering diversity and inclusion underscored by WBENC certification, Stephanie continues to shape the landscape of food service, melding her expertise with a profound love for genealogy and heritage. Join me as I dive into the remarkable journey of Stephanie Lind, a true titan of the food service industry whose story exemplifies resilience, innovation, and an unyielding passion for making a difference. Let's go ahead and welcome Stephanie. All right, Stephanie, welcome to the Titans of Food Service podcast. I appreciate you coming on here. I'm really looking forward to our conversation here today.
It's my pleasure to be here. I can't wait.
All right. Okay.
Let's stir it up.
Let's stir it up. I love the energy already. I'd like to start off with the Fiery Five food service questions. These are like fun icebreaker questions. So are you ready?
Okay. I am.
Okay. The first one is, if you could have dinner with any one person, either historical or alive, who would it be and why?
Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
Because without getting too much into religion, I'm always fascinated at how women are portrayed in history.
Yeah.
And that's a really important person in the Bible that I'm not sure has been portrayed in a way that matches perhaps who she was when she was living.
Amazing. Okay. Great answer.
You weren't ready for that one, were you?
I wasn't ready for that one, but it's a great one. What city do you live in?
I'm actually in Erie, Pennsylvania now. I spent 20 years in Chicago and on my parents' farm in Southern Illinois and did a 3-year stint in San Francisco, but I've recently moved for love. And actually, it's a nice little place. I like it.
That leads me into question number two. If someone had one night in Erie, Pennsylvania, where must they eat?
Oh, we have surprisingly good ethnic food. There are two restaurants I would recommend, actually. One's for breakfast and one's for dinner, because I don't follow the rules, so I'm going to give you breakfast and dinner. So there's a new place called Bakery on Fifth, okay. And it's a husband and wife team that are from Uzbekistan and Iran, and they do all these Turkish, like coffees, Turkish teas, and pastries that are just exquisite. Mm. So that is where I would go for breakfast. All they do lunch stuff as well. And then there's a great, I love Middle Eastern food, by the way, which you're going to see there's a theme. And then there's a little restaurant. It's a Syrian family that's been in Erie forever. It's called Casablanca.
Okay.
And it's a mother and her sons that run it. So it's a whole family. I think you always see the grandkids. You can hear them upstairs. And oh my gosh, the food is phenomenal. And the mom is literally back in the kitchen cooking. So she'll come out and say hello. And one night they didn't have the couscous that I really wanted. And so they were like, what do you want? I was like, you know what? Just tell mama. I just call her mama at this point. Just tell mama to surprise me. So the food's phenomenal. And again, it's a family business, which is what I love about food service. Yeah. And again, I like supporting the small business, small restaurant owner.
Again, great answer. That leads me into my third question. If you could only have one type of cuisine for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Chocolate.
Chocolate. Just one answer. Perfect.
Chocolate and champagne. Can I have them together?
I think you can.
Dessert. So it's probably the answer.
I'd probably say the same. Maybe ice cream or something. Are there any foods or dishes you've wanted to try but haven't yet?
I really want to go to Asia. Like I've been to Singapore and I've been to Hong Kong. But I'd really like to go through and do more of the like really, really hardcore ethnic food. I just am not sure. I say that. I don't know if I have it in me.
Okay.
But I feel like it's something I need to experience because it's so different from how we eat here.
Yeah. Okay.
So, can I change my answer?
You can.
I'd really like, I minored in Russian studies in college and I'd love to go to St. Petersburg or Moscow and have actual borscht and an actual sort of Russian tea service. So that's my second answer.
Okay. I think that's a great second. Do you have a favorite food-related memory from traveling?
Oh, from traveling?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I do remember being in Singapore, which is, if you've never been, put it on your bucket list.
Okay.
And the food there, just by virtue of what it's like as a country, is very, there's literally everything, right? Mm-hmm. But we went to this little place down on the ocean, and they do crabs there. So they're these ginormous crabs. And so I'm with a client and her husband who are both MDs, have started biotech companies. They're really sophisticated, great people. And we're all in our bibs, you know, cracking the crabs, which I don't love doing that, but it was so much fun. And it was so entertaining and the food was phenomenal. I think that's one where I just felt, it felt like something you do when you go to Baltimore, right? Like, so it felt like close to home, but again, sitting in this restaurant with all the side dishes and beverages that are totally different from anything you would get in the States. And then just the laughter of being with people who were just really great, smart people. And we're all in a plastic bib eating, you know, with mallets banging around on our dinner.
That sounds like an incredible experience. Well, thank you for humoring me there on the Fiery Five food service questions. Now, maybe a little for those following along or listening along, a little background on yourself. Who are you? What is your business? Let's start there.
Yeah. So I am someone who spent 23, 24 years working for really big companies. So my first job was on a truck at Frito-Lay, which at the time, 92, there was a recession. And my mom said, I've paid for your college. You can't come home, get a job. And so that was the job I could get coming out of a liberal arts college that really put out lawyers and bankers. And I was like, that's not for me. But it wound up being the best training for just my career. And fast forward to 2014, I'd gone to work for a big company and it wound up not being a good fit for me. It was clearly not a good fit for them. And I had moved to a place I didn't really want to live and said, like, this isn't working for me, and started my company. Because can I say a naughty word?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say it. You can blurt me out. But I said, I want to be the only other asshole I ever work for. Right. Yeah. I want to go work for the company that I want to work for. And my parents were both small business owners. So that it wasn't an unusual or sort of foreign concept. So I did that 9 years ago and here we are. You know, literally like a week ago, we turned 9 with 40 employees and clients from all over the globe and doing things I love and working with people that make me laugh, that make me feel valued, but don't give me any room to, you know, get too big for my britches or to, you know, not follow through. So I feel really fortunate to do what I do at this point. I don't know if that's enough sort of context. I'm happy. Like, if you want this to be an advertisement for my company, I'm happy. I just,
yeah,
I can tell you more about
it. Let's dig a level deeper. Why, you know, if you look back 9 years ago, why did you start Alohi?
Yeah. So it's interesting. What I tell people now is it wasn't that I was hitting the glass ceiling. I'd made it to vice president at Sigma, which is a division of Cisco, had a $2 billion P&L. I was a vice president at a digital marketing company. I was a vice president at Kerry Ingredients. I mean, I had big jobs, big titles. So it wasn't that part of it as much as it was, I had felt like I had concrete walls. And in retrospect, right, so I'm a slow learner, but I do learn. My makeup is not meant for big companies, right? Okay. So I'm very creative. You know, if I see something that doesn't make sense, I want to do something different. I love to break things, fix them, and then move on, right? I can remember when I left that job at Kerry, a recruiter said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, my ideal job is one where I go and do something for 12 to 18 months. I fix it and I go do the next thing. Mm-hmm. And literally their eyes got really big and they're like, yeah, I don't know what to do with that. And I think that was the first time that in my head I went, well, of course you don't know what to do with that. That I don't fit. That's what's been happening. So I started the company really as a way to, I think, give myself some peace of mind around, because a lot of layoffs, right? So I was at PepsiCo for a while and there were a lot of layoffs up until 2008. And then I was in retail first, right? So mm-hmm. I'd moved to food service. I was there for about 2 years. The Great Recession hits in 2008 and get laid off with 3,000 of my closest friends. Right. But I loved food service, but I was tired of getting laid off. I was tired of like, what next? Do I have to? And that's the other thing they don't tell you about being a VP is you're a lot more at risk, particularly if you're a VP of sales. I mean, it just mm-hmm. is the nature of the beast. So there's a lot more risk. And I was the breadwinner. But more than anything, it was just like, I just didn't fit, right? The mm-hmm. like, what makes a big company work is, you know, a lot of people all rolling the same way at the same time. Like, kill me now. Like that, if you were to say, Stephanie, what does hell look like? I'd say, that's what that was.
That's what it looks like.
That's what it looks like. And the same thing all day, every day. And everyone else is doing the same thing too. And so I started the company knowing that I had a really good network. Mm-hmm. I love food service, but I felt like my background with retail and ingredient or industrial, plus having worked for a distributor, meant I had some value. I just needed to figure out what that looked like. And so my first order of business, honestly, was going to Expo West. Mm. So that was one of the first, 4 weeks after I formed my company, I went to Expo West because the other side of it was also that my mother had breast cancer. And so the other thing this was going to allow me to do was have some more flexibility so I could, you know, go home as needed and be with her and actually move down to their farm for 3 years. But it allowed me to see at Expo West all the ways that food, especially if you're coming out of big CPG companies, how like that there are all these mission-based companies, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd never been before. And it was just, my mind was blown. I thought, oh my God, these are my people because it's entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are doing things that make zero sense. I love that, right? Just to talk to them about why they're doing it. And I also realized that they all wanted to talk about food service, but dear Lord, they had no idea what it was about. And so that's when I started to formulate in my head, like, okay, I think I can teach people about food service. And again, being a consultant is really different too than working for a big company, because you start to think about, like, I want to help all the little guys, but I can't pay the bills if I'm not thinking about who I'm working with and how do I price it. Which again, I love puzzles and it was a big puzzle to figure it out. But it was that first year where I had the money to take the time to think about it. I cashed in my Pepsi pension and said, I'm going to give myself until this runs out. And if it doesn't work, then I'll get a J-O-B. I'll want to stab myself in the eye, but I'll get a J-O-B. And I literally was down to the last $300 of that pension and got my first big check from a client. And I went, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
And it was so, and by the way, that was for I was doing retail for a startup, because again, strategy, thinking through strategy is, it's less about, are you a complete expert in the channel? And it's more about, do you know how to pull all the things together, supply chain, marketing, the financials, cash flow, what are your investors and board going to think? So that's how we got started. And, you know, we pivot every year, mm-hmm. if not twice a year, because the industry and the consumer are pivoting. But yeah, I set out to build the company I wanted to work for in terms of who we hire, how we hire. We pay for all the employees' benefits. They get a lot of time off. They get like half day, Friday, half days all summer. They get full Fridays from Thanksgiving to New Year's. Because again, I think we're our best selves when we have time to go be mm-hmm. with our family or do things for ourselves.
I totally agree with that.
It's not easy. Yeah.
With that philosophy.
It's not easy, as you know, like payroll shows up and you're like, holy crap, here we go again. Every mm-hmm. 2 weeks, it's like clockwork. But it's also really fulfilling to know that you're helping the client, but also that you're providing a good living and hopefully a happy place to work for employees.
Yeah, absolutely.
The employees that fit.
Yeah, that's important. You mentioned doing multiple pivots. Where does your company fit now in the food service industry? What are some of the deliverables that you provide to your clients that you work with?
Yeah, so I get a ton of calls from people saying, I need a broker. Can you sell for us?
Yeah.
To which my response is, we're not a broker. I'm happy to tell you what we do, but we're not a broker. And it's funny because I literally just posted something on LinkedIn. I had somebody tell me recently, Stephanie, like the industry knows you don't like brokers. So it's like, it's not that I don't like brokers. It's that I believe the model is broken. I don't think manufacturers are fair to brokers. And I also don't think that for the most part, you can make a decent living doing it because there are too many unknowns. Mm-hmm. So what we do, and I love what we do is, so it's kind of two-sided. So we have we're kind of known for plant-based and startups.
Okay.
Because that's the part that people see. We actually work with some really big companies. You won't see us talk about that so much just because of the non-disclosure we have to sign. But at the end of the day, we want companies to come to us that have innovation. Again, it can be a new-to-world company. We've worked with companies that don't even have a product yet, and we have some that shouldn't have had a product yet that had produced a lot of something that wasn't going to sell. And in some cases, it's a big company that has an innovation and they're not sure what to do with it. So a perfect example is a really, really, really big company that came out with some really great innovation. And it's like on point for consumers and where they're going, but it doesn't look anything like what is in their core business. And their salespeople just couldn't sell it. I mean, they had it is approved at DOT. It's approved with all the GPOs, but it's not where their people are used to going. And it's not a conversation they're used to having. And so what we do is we fill in the gaps. So if you were to think about how we would work in tandem with Portillo marketing, sales marketing, what we would do is be really the top of the funnel, okay. Get the flywheel going so that your team can take it and close it. Right. And then we're following up to say after the fact, oh, are you still ordering? Can we get you some materials? It's filling in the gaps for companies that have innovation that don't have the resources. And by that, I mean either people or just the time to go after the innovation that they need to sell today to be in existence in 4 or 5 years. And they can't do that. And I live this as a sales rep at Pepsi doing innovation. And frankly, at Nabisco and Frito-Lay as well, where I'm going to hit my number or not based on what I do for the base of my business. Mm-hmm. And I want my bonus. I am money motivated as a salesperson. So am I going to sell a bunch of Oreos or am I going to go sell that new thing? Well, I'm going to go sell a bunch of Oreos because I know they're profitable and right. And I'm going to hit my bonus. So we're really about taking the pain out of innovation and giving it the life it needs so that when it makes it either to the direct sales team or to the broker, it is successful. Or if it's not going to be successful, you haven't just spent God knows how much of the salesperson's time or the broker's time pushing something that maybe needs to be tweaked, or it can really only go to a niche part of the world. So I would argue that we're kind of the front and the end of the sales cycle to make sure that the people in between who have the kind of the more expensive headcount can go close the bigger, more strategic things, right? And kind of push the base business or the core, what's keeping the lights on.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, in my experience working with manufacturers, that introducing new innovation, it's a big challenge for a lot of manufacturers. Did they have the right product? Are they, did they do the right rollout? Did they do, you know, all of these different things? Production and operations may think they have the right item, but maybe it's not a fit, or maybe it's not priced right, or whatever it may be. So I think what you're doing is very important for manufacturers and for the food service industry.
Yeah, it's funny because we do get lumped in a lot with brokers, and we always say we're not a broker, and it's not. Mm-hmm. Again, I've had some phenomenal brokers in my past, but having them was how I figured out. Frankly, a lot of manufacturers just train their people to be broker pokers, which is lazy.
Yeah,
that's what one of my brokers called one of my salespeople. He was not wrong. and again, like it's such a big, complex channel. Mm-hmm. That I think we have to all get more honest about what we're good at and what we're not good at. And I know, because I had a lot of clients early on that wanted, like, I'll pay you commission if you'll launch my product. And I was like, so $0 of your 50% commission is still $0. Like, I just did the math. Mm-hmm. And so some of this is also pushing back on the manufacturing community and saying, look, you're not good at new product rollouts. You know, it's easy to blame the broker or blame supply chain. Like, so there's just, it's gotten really easy, especially since 2008, to have a big blame game. And this roll up between Key Impact and Waypoint is making me crazy, because it's just more of the same, except now there's just complete chaos. And I've talked to a lot of friends that are with one of the two of them or one of the other brokers. And it's just stupid, because everybody keeps doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Over and over and over.
Yeah. What effects do you see from the roll up here currently today, and maybe some longer term things that you see happening in the future?
Yeah. So the first thing is, and I feel for them, right? So mm-hmm. the Key Impact and Waypoint, first of all, they laid off I'm assuming half of their people, right? So
yeah.
Half of the workforce is gone, but they technically still have twice as many brands. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out, because this is just the way it goes, like, who do we want to keep and who do we not want to keep? But we don't want to lose them just in case we don't get to keep them, right? So they're doing that thing where they're trying to spin the plates. And I'm talking to a lot of people behind the scenes going, yeah, no, we've already talked to somebody else. We've got a new broker, or like, we know that this isn't going to work because they've got that line who's much bigger. So they're going to keep that one. And again, I understand why they're doing it. And I'm sure they learned a lot from the Cora Costa merge, where I think they were pretty upfront with a lot of brands about, like, hey, we're not going to keep you. But then things didn't work out the way they thought they were. But it's, if all they're doing is merging Waypoint and Key Impact, and frankly, doing things the same, which it's private equity, right? So that comes with its own host of challenges in terms of how they view doing a roll-up or an acquisition and then supporting the business. They're looking, they, and by they, I mean the new company, but also every manufacturer that's tied to that, either one of those organizations, they're looking at 6 to 12 months of complete chaos. Mm-hmm. Whether they stay with the Key Impact Waypoint group, where half the people are gone, and so those might have been the people that knew how to sell their product, and now they've got to train the new people.
Yeah.
Half of whom are probably looking for another job, because that's just what happens when you have a layoff. Been there, mm-hmm. done that on both sides. And then you've got those who are going, well, there's no way they're going to keep me, so now I got to go find another broker. And so they're looking around, but conflicts galore. And the bigger you are, yeah. and more complex your business, the harder it is to make that work. So those folks are going, like, now I've got to figure out how to train somebody new. And what nobody's thinking about is, how much time are you losing? Because you've spent all the effort training the team that you have, and the team you have now may not be trained on your brand. And that does not happen fast. And now you're going to have to go train a totally new client. And then, oh, by the way, since you've told them you're leaving, are they now converting your customers over to whatever line is staying? Like, it's just, that happens. And then you've got those going literally, and I've got some good friends in senior roles who are very bright people, but don't necessarily have a food service background, but have fallen into like food services underneath them. And it's particularly for some of the smaller or emerging brands where they're just literally like, I don't know what to do. So they're literally like, I don't want to say head in the sand. It's a little bit of that, but it's more deer in the headlights. Mm-hmm. And the headlights are a train. And rather, and again, it's, we continue to talk about how you sell in the channel the same way we've always talked about it, right? And you're either direct or you have a broker. If you have a broker, then you have RSMs and maybe you do the national accounts. Nobody's stopping. And by nobody, I mean the, like, especially the national brokers. I think when you're regional or specialized, you have the ability to maybe be a little more niche and to sort of own how you do things. But the big national guys, they're like, they don't have the time, frankly, or the money to stop and think about their model. And that's unfortunate because a lot of brands are going to struggle. A lot of employees are going to, you know, be impacted, and they struggle with not being able to make money. Because I've done the math and make all of those principals happy, which they can't, and continue to do it the way they've been doing it.
Where do you think?
I don't even know what to say now. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to be kind.
Yes.
But I am actually really just irritated at the industry for not like looking at each other and saying, guys, it is not the same.
Yeah.
It is. It does not function the same way it did. We have to do it differently. But I also know that's hard.
I know you've referenced a couple times 2008. And if you look back, going all the way back to then, you know, at this point, maybe what, 15 years ago, what have you seen as changes in the industry as a whole? And do you like those changes?
So 2008, Great Recession, obviously, like it just blew up everybody's business regardless, right? Operator, distributor, manufacturer. And we were all kind of feeling the same pain. You turn around to like 2012, 2013, and you have Cisco doing category management. Mm-hmm. That to me, more so even than 2008, was what changed the industry. And I don't think for the good. I understand why Cisco did it. And I think I was at Cisco at the time. I didn't think it made sense for, you know, from a manufacturer standpoint. I was the anomaly because I was a manufacturer all the way up until that point. But I also understood, because I understood how hard it was to make money as a distributor, that they had to do something. But what that did then is, as part of that, Cisco created the blessed five or blessed six, right? So they designated, these are the only brokers we're going to deal with. And it was the big guys. At the time, there were six, and that included IBA. And I remember banging on the door and going like, really? Like, what about the brands who can't get in, or the brands who don't need a national broker? Or again, because I'd worked at Cisco, I was able to go in and have some conversations. But it would, to me, that was the turning point for the industry, where I think in some ways the broker model was completely broken, because as a manufacturer, you had to fill out like all your pricing, included like, I have this broker here and I'm going to pay them 5% or 3% or 1%, whatever it was. And you had a distributor. I don't want to say they were dictating, but they had a lot of visibility to things that, frankly, I don't think were their business. I would argue there are a lot of manufacturers, especially ones that are new to food service, that want to get into the discussion like, well, what's a distributor's margin? It's none of your business. Their contract is with the operator. Your contract is with them. Like, that's your contract. Right. But that to me put so many of the little guys out of business that weren't, or forced consolidation that didn't need to happen. Because if you didn't have a national broker, you couldn't deal with Cisco. And then you follow that up with the cutting edge solutions and the scoop. And then you had distributor consolidations. I'm trying to think what else. Well, and then obviously you get to COVID. And then, like, to me, COVID was, honestly, it accelerated all the things that needed to happen. that nobody was talking about, and we're still not talking about, right? I think it's 64% of B2B buyers don't want to talk to a sales rep until they've decided they want to talk to a sales rep. They want to be able to go get everything they need online. Yeah. And so again, when I think about the model today, if your model is I'm going to have a guy dragging a bag going door to door to door, and you're calling on millennials, they don't want to see you, mm-hmm. right? They want to be able to go do their research and then call you when they need it. And I'm not saying that's for everyone or it's the only way to do it. But again, I don't think the industry has stopped, at least at the higher levels, to think about their model from the customer's point of view. Mm. Because the manufacturers and brokers, and when I say brokers, I mean the big guys, they have this relationship that is codependent as much as it is interdependent. So there are a lot of people who their job is basically to keep things the status quo. And people don't like change. Humans mm-hmm. don't like change.
That's right.
But if your customer is now a millennial and not a boomer, and they like technology and they want to work from home 2 days a week or, you know, fill in the blanks, and they have a consumer that doesn't want things the way they used to get it and they want to have it delivered or like all the things. And I just don't think the models have changed enough to accommodate the change in behavior.
You may not have the answer to my next question, but how would you disrupt it? How would you disrupt the industry of how it's set up right now?
Well, I think that's what we have been trying to do for 9 years at Alohi.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, let's all admit what we're good at, mm-hmm. right? And let's be really open and honest about what we're not good at. Let's pay our partners and treat our partners fairly, right? So the brokers have to stop saying that they can do everything because they can't. And they have to stop taking on lines and saying they can pioneer because they can't. Mm-hmm. And they have to push back on the manufacturer and say, I get that you have this new innovation, but that is 10 times harder than what I already have in the bag. So pay me fairly for that work. Or let's talk about how we do that differently. On the manufacturer side, they have to stop. If they're the top 10 principals, they have to take a step back and understand that the only way that broker's financials work is if they take the next 40 or 80 or 500 lines, but they're mm-hmm. getting the bulk of the benefit. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, the manufacturers, until they go to something that's not in the top 10. And if you're in the bottom, like not in the top 10, then you get really honest with yourself about, you know, what are you getting? What are you paying for? Mm-hmm. But also, are you being a good partner and providing the tools they need? And if you're only the only way you're interacting with the broker is to beat them up because you've got a meeting with your boss. Well, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that to me is part of it. Brokers are not good at national chains. They just aren't. They're not good at innovation. They don't do customer retention well, right? So nobody's doing the back end of, okay, did they actually buy? And listen, salespeople for manufacturers are just as bad at this, but it's that like, oh, they said they were going to buy it, closed one. Really?
Yeah.
Did the distributor bring it in? Did it make it to the restaurant? Did they actually serve it? How did it go? Are they mm-hmm. going to order it again? Do they know that you have these other products? So it's, again, to me, the disruption is understanding that the front of the sales funnel and after the sales funnel mm-hmm. are the two pieces that where the manufacturer and broker relationship doesn't work. And because you can't track that with commission, right? Leads into the funnel aren't money because mm-hmm. the distributor's not buying it yet. Mm-hmm. And doing the follow-up customer retention, customer experience doesn't necessarily fall into the funnel either. Because what if they fell off? And now you're going to spend another 2 to 3 months trying to figure out, like, can we get it back in? What issues do we have? So to me, the disruption is creating a suite of services that allows any manufacturer of any size to get those things done. And I'll give you an example of how we're doing this today. So we have a client that has direct and broker, right? So they have one product line that is more complicated as equipment and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's direct. And it probably needs to be because I did beverages, like I had all the Da Vinci syrups, like that's hard to do for a broker. Mm-hmm. And so this is that times 10. But then for more of their commodity business, they have brokers. The challenge is if the broker gets a lead, that lead might actually be looking for what's over here, but they're not talking, right? For a lot of reasons. And mm-hmm. So our job is actually to take all the leads in, qualify it. We're agnostic to who's going to sell it. We don't care who gets paid for it. That's not how we get paid. Our job is to pull it in, get as much information as possible, and then send it back out to where it needs to go on both sides, so both sides know what the opportunity is. And then we're also going and following up after the fact to make sure, like, did somebody follow up? Did you get what you needed? How did it go? Do you need more recipes? Because again, we're agnostic about the commission piece mm-hmm. because we're not in the middle. Can we help them get into distribution? Yes. But if they have a broker or direct team, then we don't need to do that. That's fine. For some clients, they need that assistance, so we'll help them. That's from earlier stage. But the disruption, and I think the second disruption, Nick, and I'm curious to know how you guys are doing this.
Yeah.
It's if you look at back like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, like food service marketing, first of all, it's just not sexy, right?
Yeah,
so if you get people out of CPG or whatever, like that is some sexy, fun marketing. Mm-hmm. So, but food service marketing is imperative and it has to be done for the channel the right way. And so I think the other big disconnect in the industry right now is sales and marketing aren't very good for the most part about working together for the channel. And I think especially if you have a broker, right? You've got a marketing team that probably doesn't interact at all with the broker. You're filtering it up through an RSM probably. Mm-hmm. And so is the marketing department, they're so far disconnected from what's actually happening with the customer. It makes it easier for them to say, oh, well, it's clearly sales, right?
That's well said.
Our model is like we do the marketing and we do the sales. And frankly, they are like literally it's one. Like, I don't believe at this point, and I wouldn't have said this 6 years ago, to be honest. I think the changes since COVID have accelerated it. But I think if you have a sales team and a marketing team and they're not both accountable for exactly the same metrics, then you're going to have a disconnect.
I totally
and
agree.
Our CMO, Catherine, who's amazing. Yeah. But she's in our CRM for the salespeople. Literally, we're talking just before this. We have a client that we're doing a really cool project for, and she literally goes in and reads every comment that the salespeople are putting in about this product, because what it tells her is literally, you know what, I need to tweak this, or they're not picking up on this, or and it's, you know, but whose marketing does that?
Very few.
Right? And so she is as much of a salesperson as our salespeople. And it's, but that doesn't happen.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It doesn't really, it doesn't happen. There is a disconnect on the food service side between marketing and sales. A lot of times from my lens on the broker side, you know, the manufacturer will provide point of sale or things like that, and it may not be pertinent to what we're doing. But I feel like a lot of times the marketing side is really on the sales teams to figure out how to do it. And so now it's a lot of times it's salespeople trying to be marketing people simultaneously. And so there is a disconnect there. And so you definitely hit on a key point.
Yeah, that's not allowed at Alohi.
I love that.
Full stop. Yeah.
Looking far into the future, what do you hope to see in the food service industry that's not currently there right now?
I would like to see a lot more diversity, first of all.
Okay.
I thought by now we'd be there, but I don't see it because I think it's important when you look at kind of who comes up through food service on the restaurant side, it is heavily female and minority. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the manufacturers and the brokers and the distributors, we don't look like that at all. And I think that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
that's, but I'm hoping for that for the world as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other piece is, you know, again, I would like to see the players take a step back and ask themselves, have they structured the business to maximize their profits or minimize their losses, depending on who they are, regardless of the impact on the customer, right? So again, if you're the customer and you don't want to see somebody, like, but you're going to send somebody in because the manufacturer expects that, mm-hmm. versus telling the manufacturer that customer doesn't want to see anybody, right? And this is how they buy. Like, I'd like to see a lot more candid conversations about how the world really works. And again, I get back to what are you good at and what are you not good at? How do you make money and how do you not make money? And, you know, I think the onus is a lot on the manufacturers for that because they continue to press for more and more. Brokers continue to nod their head because they can't afford to lose the money because it's mm-hmm. propping up so much of their SG&A.
You're right.
But that's not a partnership. It's not mm-hmm. a partnership. So don't call it that if that's not what you're going to do.
Very well said. Very well said. Stephanie, I think a lot of people... I think this is going to be a popular episode for one. I really enjoy your candidness. And for those that want to, for those that want to work with you and Alohi, what is the best way to reach out to yourself or maybe to someone in your company to start an engagement and a conversation with you?
Yeah. I mean, they can come in through the website, obviously, or okay. they can, like, I love LinkedIn. I've been on since I think 2004. I'm mm-hmm. the OG of LinkedIn and food service. So they can find me there. And
I didn't realize it was around in 2004.
Yeah. No, I was literally like, I think in its first year or two, I love technology. Wow. Everybody laughs at yeah. me at the company. I'm like, look at this one. But yeah. And if somebody wants to have a conversation and a no bullshit conversation mm-hmm. about the industry and how to think about it, I'm game for that. I'm not game for doing it the same way it's been done. Because right now it's not really working for most people. Like you've got to be like the inbound from all this merger stuff has got to be in some ways feel like Christmas, but also a little overwhelming because what's the churn for the rest of your portfolio right. while you're trying to figure that part out?
Right. Yeah. It's uncharted waters for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't see it changing. How do you see, like, I read your dad's story about being fired and, you know, those sorts of things. And you guys wanted to stand up the business. You wanted to stand up.
Yeah.
Has it been 10 years for you?
Yeah. We've been in business now for nearly 9 years.
Yeah. Oh, I would have shared my birthday cake with you.
So we started in 2015. And when we got into the business, my dad had, he worked for Food Sales West, which at the time was the largest broker in the mm-hmm. West. And then it rolled up into Advantage Waypoint. And then when he concluded his time with Advantage Waypoint, we started our business together. And it's so funny. Some of the, like, you're so knowledgeable on the industry around that time of, you know, the broker consolidation and the category management with the broadliners. Like that's when we started, and terrible time to start mm-hmm. a brokerage business. Yeah, when we did.
Yeah.
And yeah. we had it, I mean, from every different angle. It was like, no, no, no. You know, people, they don't like new, they don't like change. Mm-hmm. And so we're like, let's just focus at what we call mm-hmm. the strategic account. Let's actually have relationships with people that we can build sustainable business for our manufacturer partners. And we've kind of just stayed in that lane. And it was really hard to start, but especially mm-hmm. as we came out of COVID, it started to form for us, and we started to get better and more attention and also trying to be disruptive and think about it differently. Cause the way it's always been, that option is
which
there
this
for
industry does not like.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And so we're like, how can we pump in marketing and innovation and energy and passion into brands that maybe have gone stale, or they just feel like no one pays attention to me. But it's also, I like what you said too about partnership. It's, you know, I'm not in the business of wanting to work with someone who's just going to micromanage me or put unrealistic expectations. You know, if I can't do something, we're going to tell you we can't do it. It's important to be upfront and honest, right. even if those conversations are hard to have. But it you know the broker model so well, you know, and even the way you describe some things, I'm like, that's exactly how I think and feel and see the industry. And I'm Mm-hmm. You know, hopeful with this whole the roll up and everything. I know it's chaotic right now with brands moving and people moving, maybe people coming into the industry or leaving it, the industry, whatever it may be, that when it settles out, I think there's room for new opportunities and new companies to form and new ideas, which I'm really looking forward to, and bring you know, new balance and new thought leaders to, you know, to the table. I love what you said about diversity as well. I think there's a big area of improvement in food service, at least from what I've seen. And I think there's a lot of, I'm hopeful that there's a lot of opportunity for people that maybe haven't had as much opportunity in the past.
Well, I think it's going to take people like you and like me who don't want to do it the way it's been done and are okay saying no or no thank you. And again, I literally just posted something on LinkedIn and I'm getting ready to fire it up and make it even more interesting. But I also think that people that have been around for a long time and have been part of the ecosystem and that don't agree with how it's being done, they need to speak up, mm-hmm. right? If you're going to be part of the problem, be part of the problem and stop complaining, because you're impacting people's lives, whether it's the manufacturers, business and their employees, or the broker's employees or manufacturer's employees. It's just like, I'm just not game for that anymore. Mm-hmm. We're in a people business, literally, like all of it. And I think everybody needs to start thinking about the human toll of what the industry is doing and how they're doing it.
Wholeheartedly agree, for sure.
I'll get off my soapbox now.
Stephanie, this has been a great conversation. And as I mentioned, I think a lot of people are going to resonate with this episode. And this will be one where someone will say, hey, I listened to that, your one episode, and you're so right, or I learned this, or it's so funny the responses that I get from people. And I think this is going to be a really good one. So just thank you so much for time to meet with me. And
I really appreciate it. It's a conversation we have to have.
It is. I like your candidness too. Like, just put it out there.
It's my superpower. Exactly. That's what I call it. That's not what a lot of other people call it.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. I really appreciate it.